Venezuela conclusion.
Thank you very much for the invitation. Thanks for coming. So this seminar tries to tell you something about the condensed matter physics and also tries to make a connection maybe to black hole physics, or at least show you how ABS-CFT correspondence can be useful to learn something about condensed matter. So the outline is first an experimental motivation for looking at the Nernst effect, which is just one out of many thermoelectric response measurements you can make, and which are particularly very interesting to understand superconductors, in particular high temperature superconductors. Then I will discuss with quantum criticality and what we expect in the vicinity of a quantum phase transition, where conformal field theory comes into play, and therefore a connection to anti-Desiter space later, where we make a connection with string theory. But before making this connection, I will show you a hydrodynamic analysis of the thermoelectric response, and then finally compare the results to experiments in the end. So the systems that I'm primarily talking about are superconductors, and in particular high-temperature superconductors, and one specific material is lanthanum strontium copper oxide, which is one of the high-TC materials, and the prominent structure here is the planes which contain copper atoms, the blue ones with oxygens around them, and the lanthanum atoms are basically electronically inert in the sense that the superconductivity happens here in these planes, but the doping with strontium, when you replace the lanthanum, acts as an electron sucker. That means the electrons are going to the strontium, and there are effectively holes remaining in the copper plane, and that gives rise to superconductivity if you dope sufficiently many holes per unit cell. The phase diagram of such materials is as follows. If you have no doping down here, here's the doping concentration, you just get a dull antiferromagnet because you have one electron per unit cell, so you get just localized spins on the coppers, and that's an antiferromagnet. That's not interesting. We are interested in a finite density of holes. And if you're about at 5-6% of doping, up to 25% of doping, you get superconductivity up to fairly high temperatures. That's why they're called high TC materials. And real superconductivity, meaning phase coherence and zero resistance, occurs below this dome here. But even above the TC, you see a very, very remarkable response in the thermoelectric response measurements that is the focus of this talk, and that's the Nernst effect. And that is particularly interesting because there has been a long-standing puzzle what is actually the nature of these high TC materials in the phase up here, which is called the pseudogap phase, which is distinct from a normal metal, the Fermi liquid, as we are used to it from, say, aluminium or some other standard metal. So what I'm going to be mostly concerned about is to understand the region here of doping around what is called the underdoped regime. It's the doping below the maximum of this dome, where this pseudogap physics plays an important role.
Does the Nernst signal terminate exactly where the dome
terminates? No. It's actually being observed even over here, but here it's most pronounced.
On the left.
Here, now it also goes further.
Excuse me, regarding to your picture as high doping, it means that the Nernst effect and the superconductivity dome, they overlap with each other?
We'll see data later. This is just a motivation picture. It's not very accurate. So what is the Nernst effect? It's just one choice measurement that you can make to see for example, traces of superconductivity, and people are interested in seeing superconductivity above TC, as I will motivate later, because the high TC compounds are very distinct from the usual superconductors in that. Superconductivity is already present before the real phase transition. And the Nernst effect is one way to probe that. And what on that is just what applies a thermal gradient. Matter flows down to lower temperature, and one has a magnetic field applied, and what one is measuring is the transverse voltage that occurs. Now, if the system is a superconductor, then the magnetic field creates vortices, and the vortices flow down here. And if you now measure the voltage here, then you see vortices traversing your line over which you measure voltage. And then by the Josephson relation, you see facelifts all the time. The rate of facelifts gives you a finite voltage, or actually a finite electric field. And the Nernst signal is simply the electric fields divided by the thermal gradient that you apply. So why is that a good measurement of, say, superconducting features? Well, actually, there's a Nernst effect in any material, but in a Fermi liquid, which is a dull metal, it's extremely small, this signal. That's due to some cancellation, which occurs in simple transport, and the fact that we see a big Nernst signal in cuprates in these high TC materials is a sign for some unusual physics going on, so superconductivity going on even above TC. So, as I said, one is particularly interested in this effect in high TC because these are kind of special superconductors that there. Actually, two ways a superconductor can become phase coherent and have zero resistivity. If you look at the order parameter, which has an amplitude of the phase, there is either the usual BCS type transition where just the amplitude goes to zero at TC. That is the standard thing that happens at low TC materials. But then there is another scenario which can occur, in particular in two-dimensional systems, that the phase transition occurs just because a phase is opening without really spoiling the amplitude locally. And then people talk about a vortex liquid which survives above TC. So even though you don't have phase coherence and zero resistance, you still have a lot of local pairing and actually superconducting fluctuations. And that is what we want to probe with the Nernst effect. So, and indeed, now I'll show you some experimental data for this material that I showed you in the beginning, this LSCO, Landstrom-Strontium cuprate. Here's again the doping and the temperature.
I have a question. I don't know if you can answer that since phantom question. So these are Ong's results, right?
Yes, right.
So, he's been doing these measurements for a number of years, right? So do you know what has been what's the evolution, like what has been the progress from an experimental or theoretical context over the years from his measurements?
I'm not sure I can give somehow a real evolution. There has been more and more data and more details about, where things become maximal and how things depend on compounds, but I'm not really aware of.
It's been seen in all the ITC materials? Or?
Yes, basically, yeah. But details differ in how this looks here, especially around some critical doping, how it looks in the overdoped regime and so on. So here you see the Nernst signal as a function of temperature, and say for a metal, a typical value is maybe 10. And here you see that as you approach TC, TC is this line here, the Nernst signal becomes extremely strong. And even if you are twice above TC, you have an extremely strong response. And now, as you will also see here, you have a clear dip in TC, which corresponds to about 1/8 doping. And that is an important feature. Actually, one believes that in the cuprates at 1/8 filling, one is very close to a malt insulator that competes with the superconductor. And so one believes that there's a quantum critical point in this vicinity. So if you could change the material properties a bit at 1/8, you might actually turn the system into an insulator. And this proximity to a quantum critical phenomenon will be used later in our approach. Before that, I show you some other data on a disordered superconductor, which is quite a bit different from cuprates, but there they also measured the Nernst effect above the superconducting transition. Here's temperature, here's magnetic field, that's the color plot of the Nernst effect. And here is the Nernst effect as a function of temperature, and it looks like, well, not much information is in this data, but if you plot it in the right way as a function of magnetic length and coherence length in the superconductor, and you plot the Peltier coefficient, which is closely related to the Nernst effect, then all data collapses and there's some hidden structure. And actually, there's some simple relation that you can extract from this scaling plot, which has so far been unadjusted, but we will, from our theory, get exactly a result like that. And finally, there's a last system where Nernst effect has been measured, and that's organic superconductors. These are very complicated organic compounds that which are interested for the reason that by choosing these ingredients here, you can put yourself relatively closely to a quantum phase transition by just choosing the right composition here. You can have a superconductor that is a very strong superconductor, but you also can approximate a malt insulator. Or also the same can be achieved by applying pressure. And that's interesting because these materials have, in principle, no intrinsic disorder, and so they are very pure, and our theory might apply. Best actually.
So whereabouts is the Nernst signal large on that phase diagram?
The closer you come to this quantum phase transition. So this is actually the material that sits about here. Whereas if you sit here, then it goes immediately down as soon as you go come to TC. This is resistance that drops down at TC, and you see that the Nernst signal survives quite a bit above. Okay, so now our approach is that indeed in ITC and in these materials, one has a proximity to a quantum critical point here. It would be this transition. Here it would be the hidden malt insulator that you have at 8 filling if you could change the physics of your system. And now we want to see whether we can understand the Nernst effect at least on a qualitative level if you're close to some critical point. For that, we can consider a very simple model of the insulator to superconductor transition. That is just the Bose-Hubbard model. So there are bosons that sit on a lattice. The bosons can hop from lattice to nearest neighbor sites. They have an on-site repulsion U, and there's a chemical potential which controls the density.
So I have a question. So, so from a different perspective, if you have a magnetic field temperature phase diagram for these high temperature superconductors, right? Mm-hmm. You have a generic phase diagram, which is a normal liquid, then a vortex liquid, then some kind of vortex glass, Bragg glass state.
Mm-hmm.
And so then if you approach the phase transition from temperature at fixed field, for example,
mm-hmm.
So what can that be explained at some qualitative level from the existence of the vortex liquid coming from simply a melted vortex lattice? I mean, what's the crucial issue here from a microscopic motivation?
Well,
the picture would be that as you come from high temperature, as long as you don't have any vorticity, the signal will be small. Then you get some preformed pairs and vortex liquid, and then the signal would be strongest. Then if you get into this Bragg glass phase, the signal drops very sharply. That is also what is actually seen on this side. They interpret that as forming of a Bragg glass or a vortex lattice. And one would just want to interpret this behavior as being a vortex liquid. And now what has been measured is the temperature and feed dependence of all these signals, and there is no theory around for this, and our approach is just provide the first theory that can deal with this, with the presence of thermal and quantum fluctuations in these systems. And as I said, the idea is that we are close to a quantum critical point, which would be the closeness to a Mott insulator. So the Bose-Hubbard model has this simple structure, and you should think of the bosons here as preformed Cooper pairs that form on this lattice. And as a function of the ratio of these two parameters, you get either an insulator when this guy dominates and makes the particle number, the boson number on each side just equal to one, given infection. And then you get a Mott insulator, and you get a superconductor or a superfluid when this guy, the Hopping gate. And so the coupling is just this ratio of the two, and the phase diagram you get is as follows. The coupling is big, you get the superfluid. If the coupling is small, you get the Mott insulator. And the chemical potential is this axis here, so the Mott insulator and the commensurate density, an infection number of bosons per site. And in the superfluid, you have a free density of photons. And the idea of our approach is that our experimental system will sit close to such a quantum critical point.
But you don't have the magnetic field.
Yes, that will come in a second. So the effective low energy theory around this quantum critical point turns out to be conformally invariant. It's a conformal field theory, and the reason why this is conformal or relativistic is due to particle hole symmetry around this axis here, because when you work around in-catcher filling of the lattice, and so holes and particles, double occupancies and vacancies are equivalent, that gives rise to a relativistic structure. So this is the simplest possible low energy theory that you would.
By relativistic structure, you mean gapless, or you mean really relativistic? What's the speed of sound in this one?
That will be a material constant that we don't know. So relativistic just means that the effective action has this structure, dt psi squared and grad psi squared. And this is something that has to be determined.
And from the experiment, we don't know what the.
I will fit later today, and then that will be a fitting parameter, which turns out to be h bar v would be on the order of 15 milli-electron volt.
Okay, can you translate in terms of the speed of. I think,
yeah,
for example, what I would mean under relativistic, it's a model in which the speed of sound is one over root 3 in units of speed of light.
Okay, so then that will be about 100 to 1,000 smaller than.
Okay, so from this perspective, it's not really.
No.
Is it related to sort of. Oh, sorry. Okay. Is it related to sort of fluid density, this speed of sound?
I don't. Yes, I think so, actually. But it's actually difficult to measure this.
Are the signs the way you mean, or is there only rotation?
How that's in Matsubara space. So the power goes from 0 to 1 over the temperature. Or actually, that would be 0 temperature.
right? So we have a conformal field theory, but that's just for you to understand better. As a function of coupling, if the coupling is bigger than the critical coupling, we always have a superfluid down to zero temperature. This was zero temperature. Now this is at a function of temperature. So if the coupling is bigger than GC, we remain in the superfluid. We are here at the critical point. Take superfluid to here, then there's an insulator here, and then there's superfluid later. And if we are below the critical coupling, we have an insulating phase as a function of chemical potential. Now what we obviously have to do is add the magnetic field and the chemical potential, and both perturb the conformal invariance. So we do that by coupling in the chemical potential here and the electric potential here with the constraint, obviously, is the rotation of ASP. And that can be dealt with. And now an experimental system as a function, the only knob we have in the experiment is doping, basically, for a cuprate system. And that will give us a trajectory in chemical potential space and coupling space as a function of the doping. And that will just go somewhere around the critical point. And our analysis relies on the fact that we come close to this critical point and we can somehow make use of such a low energy theory to describe what's going on. Okay, so now I will do a hydrodynamic analysis of in the vicinity of such a critical point. And I'm motivated that we have conformal field theory, which has basically a relativistic structure, and the natural thing to do is now to look at relativistic hydrodynamics, which is of course standard in astrophysics. And I will remind you how this goes. So first we write down the energy momentum tensor, which has a familiar structure for a liquid. So U is the energy velocity vector. So when we go to the rest frame of this vector, there's no energy current, and we just have energy density in the 0,0 component and pressure in the spatial component. This will be a dissipative part, which takes into account the dissipative contributions from relaxation processes due to interactions. The current vector has this formula of particle density times this velocity vector, and again there is a correction due to the dissipative part, and that's a very important contribution. So you might wonder why is it that the current is not just particle density times velocity. Well, the fact is that this is not particle velocity, but it's energy velocity, and that's not the same thing, because there's a contribution to the energy current that is also coming from heat and not from particles. And therefore, the two have to be different, and the difference is encapsulated by such a dissipative.
Sorry, I think that now you can see why my question was relevant, because the instance use of what you say here, relativistic hydrodynamics.
Mm-hmm.
So once you have relativistic and, say, conformal,
Yes. Right,
then you have an equation of state which will give you a speed of sound very different from the one
Yes. That's
observed at your critical point.
Okay.
About 1,000 times larger.
Yes, sure. So now that's a very good question. So the relativistic structure refers to Lorentz transformations with a critical velocity V and not C. So it's not the Maxwell part of the theory that is relativistic, but magnetic field could come in just with a
fixed. But I wouldn't say that you have no choice there, because the instance you say that the trace of the stress energy tensor is zero, which what you have for the CFT, then you don't have a choice of tuning the speed of sound.
You're working in units where on that transparency where V, your V speed of sound is equal to one.
Yes.
Yeah, right. So V plays the role of the speed of light.
Right.
Right,
but
but it's still the statement that there is no way you can choose. So I guess that if I use a relativistic CFT, then I get a unique prediction. You tell me what the dimension of that CFT is, I will tell you what the speed of sound, just from the trace of the stress energy tensor. So I guess that it does not appear to me that that relativistic CFT would be a description of the...
So it may be semantics then. But, I mean, yeah. You want V to be whatever, 1/√2? Is it 1/√2?
Well, it depends here. It's right, something like that. It's in 2+1 dimension. Yeah.
But what?
Okay, we can talk later.
Yeah. Well, we also use the thermodynamic relation between energy pressure and temperature, entropy density, chemical potential, and density. When we go on. But just remember, so that this is the velocity vector, and we have two dissipative terms which correct these non-interacting terms. And we first have to figure out what these terms are. So, but nevertheless, there will be conservation laws, namely, or equations of motions. One is, of course, charge conservation, the divergence of the current is zero. The second is energy momentum conservation, and in the presence of a magnetic field takes this form, divergence of the stress energy tensor is f mu nu j nu, or that is just the Lorentz force in a less elaborate way. And if we want, we will do hydrodynamics incorporating some momentum relaxations as a scattering by impurities or something of that kind, or a finite lifetime of our particles, and that can be done by incorporating explicitly a term that relaxes the momentum part, the spatial part of the stress energy tensor.
What was that last term?
Okay, so if you you write down components at this time, this term is basically just -1/tau of the momentum density. So this projects out the energy current, and this projects onto the spatial part. And so this is a relaxation of the spatial part of the momentum and the energy current, so it's a momentum relaxation.
Something like a viscosity?
No, basically, what is it? Basically, it's just scattering at impurities, which relaxes the momentum. So particles are bumped off, and so the momentum goes to the lattice, which is not in the theory. And so you get relaxation of the momentum.
It's like a friction or something.
Yes, no, well, very loosely speaking, yeah. So now, the remaining task is to find out what these coefficients are. That's actually discussed in Landau-Lifshitz.
So why does the energy not relax?
Because, let's say, we assume that we don't we have energy conservation. We don't.
But if you're studying lattice, you can't do anything with the lattice. Maybe find out the why should there be energy conservation?
Right, okay, that is only elastic scattering, say, disorder, static disorder, which doesn't absorb energy. But in principle, one could generalize and look at energy relaxation as well. That's usually less important. So how to determine these dissipative parts here? The answer comes from entropy increase of the time. If we look at the heat current, which is just the flow of enthalpy, I corrected by a chemical potential term times current, and that gives us the entropy current, which is the heat current divided by temperature, and the principle that entropy should always increase over time relates and translates into the divergence of this current being larger than zero, and that imposes basically, this restricts completely the form of these two terms. And turns out that mu mu is proportional to, this is basically an electric field here, this is the magnetic field, a Lorentz force, so it's proportional to the acceleration, and here is the thermal gradient. And tau mu nu has the typical form of Stokes frictional force. Now, we will only be concerned with response at small k vectors, and in that limit we can forget about this term because it's of lower order in k. And now what is interesting is that the only transport coefficient that we have to introduce by hand in the theory is this free factor here, and everything else is fixed. So the only ingredient that we have to put in by hand is the free factor here, and, which has the dimension of conductivity. And that's the strength of this relativistic theory, that we have only one single parameter free, and all transport coefficients will be a function of this single input. Now, what is this input? The sigma q. It has actually a pretty universal value because we are close to a quantum critical point. And what is important to know about quantum critical points, if you tune between an insulator and superconductor, is that if you are in this regime of where temperature is the dominant power that sets all the physics, then there's actually only one relaxation time, which is set by the temperature alone. This relaxation time is just one h bar over kT, basically. That's one ingredient, and the second ingredient is that we notice that we can relax current in a relativistic theory. So current density is not conserved over time. And the reason is just if we consider a particle at home going like that, we have a total current which is zero, but the energy current is positive or non-zero, goes in this direction. Likewise, we can have such a situation, counter-propagating electrons, particles and holes. The energy current here, the momentum is zero because you have counter-propagation, but the total current goes in this direction, right? So by adding such processes by pair creation, you can relax current without violating momentum conservation in your theory. And that's behind the relaxation processes that take place here. And now, if you have this in mind, we can estimate simple arguments of what might be the quantum critical conductivity which goes into the theory. Well, in a simple Drude theory, you know that conductivity is just E over M charge density times relaxation time. Now I put in that my relaxation time will be 1 over T. The mass should be replaced by energy density over particle density, and the particle density stays here. And then I take into account that particle density typically flows like T squared in at one critical point in two dimensions, and epsilon like T to the 3. And what I get out is something pretty universal of the order E squared over H.
But Marcus, so why is particle density zero? Why does particle density zero is T squared?
Because typical length scales go like 1 over T. So density goes like T squared. Yeah. So, and now you see that this typical relaxation time and this relaxation mechanism give you naturally quantum critical conductivity of the order E squared over H, and there will be a universal free factor there that people have computed. And so this is our ingredient in the hydrodynamic form for this dissipative term here, which gives you the difference between the energy current and the particle current, right? And so let's look a bit more closely at this relation. So if you just take the spatial part of the energy current, which is the same as the momentum, and we write it in terms of J, and the corrections coming from the, from this term, then we find three terms. One is just momentum currents due to particles that flow. Then there's a heat current, which is proportional to the thermal gradient, as in any classical theory, but with a prefactor, which is the thermal conductivity, which is now given by sigma q. So you see already that the thermal conductivity is given by this quantum critical electrical conductivity directly. And then there's a third term, which is purely relativistic in nature, which is proportional to the acceleration. And that's, and you see the pressure gradient plus Lorentz force produces this contribution to the energy current. And that term only appears due to relativistic effects, and that is well known in astrophysics, actually. So just to give you a feel of this interesting relation between current and energy current. Now what we want to really compute is the response of the system to a thermal gradient and an electric field. And we want to see what are the currents and the heat currents generated by such perturbations. In linear response, we just have transport coefficients that relate currents to the sourcing fields. And these are matrices, 2x2 matrices, which have, due to rotational invariance, this structure, diagonal and off-diagonal anti-symmetric structure. The heat current is just, again, the enthalpy flow minus chemical potential contribution. Now we can also formulate thermoelectric response not in the particle picture where I drive, say, charge current with an electric field, but I can think in a vortex-like picture where I say, well, the current is my driving force and it drives vortices, and driving vortices means they create an electric field. And so I can just invert these relations into something that appears more into a vortex structure. And the Nernst effect that I was discussing is just this response function here. So the electric field created by a thermal gradient. And that's what we are after. But we are getting, of course, all the response coefficients. It's a simple problem to get that. So our task is just solve the linearized hydrodynamic equations for given initial conditions, look how that evolves in time, and from that you can, by definite procedure, read off the response functions here. So I'm not going to show you how this works, it is pretty straightforward. Instead, I will tell you what the results are. And one interesting thing is that all the response functions will be functions of frequency, and they have poles in these response functions, namely these are cyclotron resonances. So there will be poles at plus minus omega c minus a damping term. And that's for the case where there is no impurity scattering. And now the interesting thing is that the cyclotron frequency has this interesting structure, which is not the same as you would have in a classical theory. The cyclotron frequency, as you remember, for a free particle of charge 2e would just be 2e times magnetic field over mass and c. This gets replaced in our relativistic setting by the formula first. We have to account that our critical speed is not c but v, that gives this prefactor. And secondly, we have to replace mass by energy density over particle density. That gives basically the typical energy per particle. But in a temperature-dominated regime, this will be a temperature-dependent function. So we get a very non-trivial cyclotron resonance in this problem, which might be observed experimentally eventually. And furthermore, we get the damping here. This is also an unusual feature. This is also due to relativistic effects and the fact that we have this quantum relaxation driven conductivity here. If you work in the particle picture, then the poles have a damping that is proportional to b squared. If you work in the vortex picture and look at these response functions, you get a different damping, which is now proportional to rho squared. And that's just one instance of a particle vortex duality. The fact that when you work in the vortex or particle picture, you exchange rho and b and sigma q and 1 over sigma q.
So poles in the response, so cells are poles in the current point.
Yes. Yeah, so I'll show you now. So these are the cyclotron, the resonance, and the damping. And now I insert back purity scattering, and these are the complete results, and not expect to read that in full. Here are these poles that you see, omega c plus I gamma if this falls away. Now, as e goes to zero, the zero field limit is already interesting. We get the longitudinal conductance, which is the quantum contribution, plus a term that looks like a Joule form, actually. E squared rho squared, it's the familiar e squared rho times rho v squared over something that looks like a mass and scattering time. And indeed, in the non-relativistic limit, this is just reduced to the Joule form. So we get the longitudinal conductivity, which is this universal quantum contribution plus a Joule-like contribution. Thermal conductivity is also interesting and can be written in two different forms. Just appreciate that, but what is interesting about this form is that as the magnetic field goes to zero and particles dominate over vortices, because B measures the number of vortices, this goes to one, and you get the thermal conductivity that is proportional to sigma q. So it is particle dominated, and it's proportional to the electrical resistivity. Now, electrical conductivity. Now, if you go to the limit where the density goes to zero and the magnetic field remains fine, then you are vortex dominated, and you see that the thermal conductivity is now proportional to 1 over sigma q, or proportional to the electrical resistivity. And that would suggest that you can look at thermal conductivity as a particle phenomenon or a vortex phenomenon, depending on which point of view you like better and in which regime you're working. And it's again an instance of particle vortex duality. And what is most noteworthy here is, again in more detail than before, that the thermal conductivity is now given by electrical conductivities. And there's a kind of non-trivial relativistic Wiedemann Franz like relation, if you like. So there's a definite relation between thermal and electrical conductivity. And finally, our main result is, of course, the Nernst signal, which I give here. The natural unit is kB over 2e, which is not very well known, not as well known as h squared over 8, e squared over h, maybe. It's the natural quantum unit for the Nernst signal. It's multiplied by dimensionless quantities. And so the aim is to compare that later to experiment.
Can you go on? I'm sorry for asking this. So V is what? Can you say?
This is this critical effective velocity in this emergent relativistic structure.
So it should be whatever del P over del E, something like that.
Yes,
you know. That might be different. You're talking about a sort of material,
But that's, they use this
sort of fluid. Right?
Exactly,
I think this is.
No, but they use vortex fluid as a sort of a material, and they construct the hydrodynamics for this vortex fluid. So my guess is that V must be the speed of sound for the
coming from the equation of the equilibrium equation of state of this work, it's like fluid.
I mean, there will be a quasi particle mode at the critical point, which has this velocity as relating k and omega, right? That's for sure. But whether this.
But I thought I took k equals zero limit already. So,
yes.
I guess, okay, so it's very good. So you're saying that that V is a quasi particle velocity, not the.
Yeah.
It's not the speed. It's not. Yeah. I don't think it's the speed. Oh, okay.
It's not what
he
calls.
Okay.
It's too different.
Okay.
He uses
in the. No. Even in the first in the Landau-Ginzburg series,
yes.
when you wrote that
yes.
he was also a quasi-particle.
Yes.
Okay. So.
I mean, that's the only way I understand what it is. And I'm not sure it's.
Before you go to, you mentioned the. Constraint from positivity of entropy increase. Usually there's a constraint from causality too. Is that sometimes people relax that because it leads to higher order terms or something? Is that taken into account? In other words, you know, the signal shouldn't propagate faster than.
Yeah, that.
Like, I don't know if that applies.
In the setting of hydrodynamics, as I use where U is the energy and current, this issue didn't come up. I realized that when I interpret U as the charge velocity, then there are such issues, and I saw that then it's much more complicated to set it up correctly. But somehow we didn't use that explicitly in this constraint. Okay.
So you don't know if it's satisfied, does it?
No, but I think it is satisfied. Now, before going to experiments, I would like to show you that this hydrodynamics can equally well and much more elegantly be obtained by the ADS-CFT correspondence, at least as long as we restrict to the critical point. And that idea of this correspondence, as worked out by here first, I guess, is that CFT that is pictorially imagined to live here on this boundary relates to a quantum gravity theory in one dimension higher with a black hole sitting out here, and this being asymptotically anti-Desiter space, so as you approach this boundary it becomes an anti-Desiter space, and here you have a more complicated black hole metric, and it could say that the black hole physics is holographically represented by this CFT, so all the physics that is going on inside here has an equivalent on CFT, and likewise you can say if you want to compute some physical quantities of the CFT, maybe it's easier to compute it via the gravity theorem. And I should say that the black hole here is necessary to give a finite temperature to the CFT, and the temperature just turns out to be the Hawking temperature of the black hole. So the idea of using this correspondence at all is that by going to the gravity theory, one has the possibility to obtain actually exact results for the transport coefficients, and in our case that would just be this sigma q from this mapping. And second, we want to confirm that our hydrodynamics was correct, which is not so obvious. Of course, I didn't tell you all the subtleties that arise when you derive that, but it's actually not so easy to get everything correct. And it was a strong check that we got the same answer from ADS-CFT. And finally, there's a great potential of ADS-CFT because it can go beyond an hydrodynamic regime, and maybe one can even get more exact information on the critical crossover functions away from critical. So concretely what we do is we look at the supersymmetric Young-Mills theory at the critical point, which is a conformal field theory, and we perturb it with a chemical potential mu and kinetic field B, as I showed you before. And after the mapping, this maps into a black hole, which now has an electric charge and a magnetic charge to create this perturbation. Now, a bit more in detail, the black hole that we get here in this metric is actually a saddle point solution of the simplest gravitational dual to our conformal field theory that is out here. That's just an Einstein Maxwell theory inside here. And the saddle point, which you can take in a large n limit of the associated SUN theory here, has a black hole solution, which has a metric that looks very familiar to you, maybe if you know the Schwarzschild solution. We have here metric functions that when h and q are zero, are just the Schwarzschild solution. And now the idea is that this black hole solution is just a background and it corresponds to equilibrium. And if we want to know transport, we have to introduce perturbations in the metric tensor and in the Maxwell field, and then we can finally calculate the response functions. We have Cooper formula by taking derivatives of this action as a function of these deviations, which are constrained by whatever currents, for example, want to generate on the boundary. And from that, going into further detail, the result is that we get a precise agreement with magnetohydrodynamics, in particular without imposing the principle of positivity of entropy production. So we don't have to go through all this business of determining the dissipative parts of mu and tau. But this just comes out from ADS CFT, and also the positivity of entropy is ensured directly somehow by Einstein's equations. And the deep reason for that is still kind of obscure, but that's a very interesting fact. Furthermore, in this large n limit, where we hope that the whole correspondence is useful because of the calculated, one gets an exact value for this critical conductor. And further, some of our collaborators have already shown that there's potential to go beyond hydrodynamics, because one can also go to the limit where hydrodynamics breaks down, and still this method works.
So why is this gravity theory so much simpler than CFT? Why does it allow you to calculate things exactly?
I just don't know anything about this.
There's no simple answer.
It just turns out that this is a formidable mapping, which in the large n limit, which is kind of covered here, I can explain that, allows you to take here just the saddle point of this action. So it becomes a classical gravity theory, and that is relatively straightforward to compute.
So, yeah. When you said you can match everything that you said before with ADS, what's the in that model? My favorite. But
that's again, and not C, and we also should not think of these guys.
The thing is that there is no analog of quasi-particles on the this arc.
Yeah.
So there is no analog. So the only thing that I would know how to make sense of all the formulas you talked before, if I want to map them here, is to identify that with the speed of sound.
Speed of sound.
By speed of sound, I mean just again. So you talk about transport properties related to fluctuations in the metric. So mm-hmm. those would be, you know, correlation functions, some, you know, poles in the correlation function with the stress energy tensor. So those are sensitive to the speed of sound. So they will not see the, you know, they will not see the quasi-particle velocity.
I see that, okay. Well, so the thing is that the boundary theory of that bulk theory will just have this Wilson-Fischer-Fixed-Point is supposed to give the fixed point of the Gauss Hubbard model, for example. So, and that derives from the theory that I wrote down, which has this relativistic quadratic part. And in that sense, we still talk about the same V as before. Now, I'm not sure whether the sound velocity is really the same as V, but in principle, it could be calculated from.
Well, in this case, you can only this 1 over root 2 here.
Ah, of V.
Yeah. V is 1 over root 2. And in principle, it's still, you know, you might have, what I guess there are some other effects, for example, in graphene, there is always, you know, gapless. Gapless excitations, and so this is what you would call a relativistic theory. But the idea is trying to map it really what people call relativistic in the high energy theory is very difficult
because
the speed of sound is not the same.
Sure.
I mean, as come from a relativistic CFT. So, so again, one word that can be said here is that maybe the transport coefficients that you compute are universal in some sense. So. There is a larger range of validity, and I guess maybe you will talk with experiment and you will say how this sigma you compute here will match the experiment.
Yeah, the question is why the original.
Well, they're different, they're completely different models.
That's really, in a sense, what you're asking.
Well, in some sense. In some
it's
sense.
Not just there, those two.
No, it's not, it's not, it's not, because, you know, in principle, everything that he talked before. I can use any equation of state, right? Again, this is just a hydro description, so it's pretty much based on the conservation laws, right?
Yes.
So any equation of state would work, but now once you restrict your effective hydrodynamic description to a critical point, to a CFT, then you put yourself in a corner. There is not. Some of the parameters are being fixed, and what appears to be the case is that the CFT
I think
is not the same CFT as the ones that appear to be in experiment, or whatever, not the CFT. I would call that some gapless, you know, you still have sort of a gapless model, that's why you have this duality between particles and holes.
Yes.
Right. It's not really a CFT.
Right. Okay. So I think maybe the answer to the question is that if you say the speed of sound here is 1 over square root of 2, it's in units of the V that I wrote down. It's not in units of speed of light.
But then speed of light is 1.
Here you mean?
Yeah.
Well, you can't be to 1. I mean, I say this is V, it's not.
Okay. Yeah.
Why is there a speed of sound here? Is it related to photon or anything? Why do you call it speed of sound? There's no photon in this problem, right? Then why is it called speed of sound?
Well, you can look at density correlations and propagation of density, perturbations of the
fact. As long as it's gapless, is it linear dispersion?
Yes,
then it's conformal environment, and then it's then CFT, right, in the life sense.
Yes.
So.
Yeah, I think we have a mostly semantic problem. I mean, I just call the.
Doesn't
that mean
the speed of sound or speed of quasi particle? You can assume if there is such a thing exists, right?
Right.
And well, maybe phonon, you can call it
quasi particle. So what the claim I would make is that if I look at the models like this, or any models that come in ADA CFT, then I can compute a one-point correlation function. I extract equation of state.
Yeah.
From that equation of state, I can get the speed of sound unambiguously, right? Because I can do del p over del e over del p equals speed of sound squared, whatever. I call that the speed of sound.
Mm-hmm.
And then if I do a two-point correlation function,
mm-hmm.
I can also compute exactly in the models like that what's a two-point correlation function, and look at the pole.
Mm-hmm.
So you would tell me that that pole will be sensitive to what speed. So there will be a pole that will have some dispersion relation. So my claim is that the speed of that emphasizes the dispersion relation inside that pole is exactly the same as the speed of sound you compute from the equation of state.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not, what I'm saying is that there is no like a sound wave that propagates when with one, and then there are quasi particles. So in models like this.
And these are waves in the kinetic state. Go back to the equation that you wrote down.
Mm-hmm.
I forget the symbol.
There's the Ginzburg mode.
What did you call this order?
Right, psi.
These are waves in psi that travel with the speed of v.
Yes. So,
the same as waves in.
So can I rephrase it for an imbecile? So from a strictly theoretical point of view, you're saying, if I try to rephrase what you're saying, is that you can calculate the equation of states, and I'm going to get del E over del P, and I can define this ratio that has units of velocity, the speed of sound, which would be something like C over square root 3 for a photon gas. Now, I can look at my theory, and I can calculate some other correlation function, which has a pole, and a linearized around that pole, and I get some other relationship, omega equals something k, and then I will count that.
Quasi-particle velocity.
You're saying that in a context where you set up this theory as a CFT,
yes,
and constraint.
Yes,
so
the quasi-particle velocity would be exactly the same as velocity you get from the equation of state, which you normally identify with the propagation of sound.
Right.
But
explanatively, the speed of sound that we would be talking about here presumably would be longitudinal wave that the vortex liquid would sustain. Is that correct?
Yes.
Which will be different.
That it will be naively, physically, you might have thought that this is completely unrelated to the quasi-particle velocity.
Yes.
But you're saying that in a setup like this, it's tied.
It's the same.
Okay.
And that's why I was saying that there are also other models where people try to use AGA CFT. And my only point is that you have to be careful, because even though the models look like the same, they are not precisely for the same.
So we're certainly aware of the fact that I think that the easiest answer to that is, in the theory there's only V and there's no C. C is just a Clapeyron constant, and it's not used as having, you know, Maxwell-Lorentz invariance. So now let me use maybe last 2 minutes compared to experiments. So the best way to compare to experiments is actually to look at the Peltier coefficient rather than really the Nernst signal. The reason is that most experiments so far are not really so close to a quantum critical point that everything is dominated by superconducting fluctuations, but conductivity is still heavily affected by normal components. However, the Peltier coefficient is believed to be mostly vortex driven and dominated by superconducting fluctuations. So here's the result, the full-fledged result that you get for that response function. That is just how much heat current do you create by voltage. And in the quantum critical regime, where energy density and that pressure scale like t to the 3 in two dimensions, and entropy goes like t to the 2, this is an error, and the conductance is a constant, we get basically a form out that has this, depends on d and t. Now, remember the experiment that I showed you on the superconductors, that was exactly experimentally found that alpha xy over b goes like a Lorentzian b, and that's precisely what we find here from our hydrodynamic analysis. That's not very special to our relativistic analysis, because this is actually a non-relativistic limit, and you could probably get that also from a simple Drude theory, but which is what is really interesting is that in the cuprates, you also can compute alpha xy from the Nernst signal and conductivity. And what you get is some k like 1 over 2 to the 4 over quite a large range of temperature. And if you compare that with our theory for small enough temperature, this term can be neglected. And what you get out is something that indeed goes like 1 over t to the 4. And we're pretty excited about that. This may actually confirm our theory. And now it allows us to fit the two parameters in the theory and a reasonable guess for the scattering time is 10 to 9 per seconds, which you can get from through the conductivity. And that gives us a critical velocity, which is the order of 15 millielectron volt angstrom for h bar v. And so that's about 300 times smaller than the velocity of light. Now, using these values, you can now make prediction for this cyclotron frequency that I was talking about. As I told you, it's temperature dependent, so it's not a unique number. And it turns out for, say, 35 Kelvin to be about 30 times smaller than the free cyclotron frequency. A drawback is that you only could observe that in very pure samples where the pole still appears in the response function. And finally, I flash you experimental data for the NERD signal and the theoretical analysis for the Peltier coefficient, which is basically proportional to what we see here as a function of temperature and field, and in the regime above DC where our analysis goes through more reasonably. So here you see the behavior is qualitatively well reproduced. So I'll leave you with the conclusions. And so we have shown a general theory of transport in the V3 disordered vortex liquid above T of superconductors. We have seen that relativistic magnetohydrodynamics gives a very convenient way to deal with energy and charge transport at the same time. So the disentangling all these coefficients related to heat and charge transport. And I've shown you what is the relation with a black hole theory, ADS CFT. And finally, but not less importantly, we reproduce several important features of the experiment. Thank you very much.
How do you model impurities on the ADS side? So you had an additional dissipative term. Is there a way to model that?
You mean the momentum relaxation?
Yes,
that
the moment.
That cannot be, or at least for the moment, we don't know how to do it.
Yeah. I'm not very familiar with the Humphrey. Well, does it have vortex-like solutions in a magnetic field? They have the same similar structure.
Yes, if you put in a magnetic field there, you can also describe the types of vortices. Duality maps that are more or less controlled, but they can phrase them in terms of vortices.
Does the character of the superconducting phase play any role? So, for example, we know that these high TCs with D-wave superconductors. So is that an important feature?
On this level, certainly not, but probably to make contact with the experiments more closely above this kind of qualitative agreement certainly make a difference. It might be important to take fermionic degrees freedom into account and the equation of state that finally goes into the coefficients like energy density, entropy density, and so on, that will of course be affected by which kind of superconductor we have.
I'm not sure I understood. Is it the idea is that the conformal field theory is only strictly true at zero temperature? Or?
Yeah, well.
And then if so, that the effect you're looking at was a fairly high temperature.
Right.
The hope is that it, or the evidence is that there's still enough of it survives that it's at least for certain of these things, like this LTA coefficient, that it still provides a good description.
Yeah, so indeed, for example, this pseudo gap phase survives up to pretty high temperature, and so people think in general that this is a quantum critical phenomenon, or at least influence. So the hope is indeed that it can go up to very high temperature and still be controlled by this CFT at zero temperature.
What about the proximity to a quantum critical point? As many people who might take you, or certainly would argue with you about the putative quantum critical point you have at yes. 1/8 doping there. Would you consider the quantum critical point where the superconductivity is suppressed to zero temperature?
At
5%, would that be another one that people can really sort of use?
Well, I believe that is a percolated transition, a bit like you have in the superconductor insulated transition in dirty films. And so that breaks translation in lines, that disorder is important and stuff. So there's no easy low energy theory. So that kind of theory, I think, doesn't apply there really. You can still do a hydrodynamic analysis probably, and that's kind of what we did for this nanobeam silicon that I briefly showed in the end. But ADS-CFT is definitely not a good approach there.
So could you turn it around and say that the observation of these large Nernst effects that would agree with your theory are actually evidence for a quantum critical point being very close in some phase space?
No, I wouldn't go so far. I think the Nernst effect is much more general than just shows you basically that there's something more important going on than just liquid. One way of seeing that is that there's a vortex liquid, meaning that there's preformed Cooper pairs or something like that, vortex matter that reacts to whatever sources you apply. But quantum criticality we use in order to do something, whereas there hasn't been any theory before, so we can just focus to that particular point, which doesn't mean that the noise effect doesn't exist outside.
And just a couple of transparencies. When you were matching this experiment,
yes.
There was a formula 1 plus B squared.
Yes.
I thought that in some of the here,
yeah.
This one, it has also B in the numerator.
Yes.
So what happened? Oh, because, I missed, so it's alpha
yeah, yeah.
B. Okay,
yeah.
Good, thank you.
Sure. I wouldn't overemphasize this as an evidence that our theory is particularly good, because this is a simple Drude response. Has not been noticed by the experimentalist at the time, but I think that you could get from any simple report.
Okay, so it's not.
It's more interesting to figure out what this B0 is in terms of our hydrodynamic parameters, and that may contain some really interesting physics.
Mm-hmm. So the non trivial result is just 1 over t to the 4th.
Yes.
And how universal is that? Has anybody else managed to pick that up in their Nernst?
We have asked experimentalists to look at that for different dopings, and they've tried to look at data. So far, I've seen that only in 3 samples of the same material, and I'm not quite sure yet that this fits well with our ideas of how these parameters will grow. Would behave as a function of doping, it's further scrutiny.
But I guess if you're going to say that the quantum critical phenomena is a CFT, then you have no choice but have 1 over t to the 4 scaling.
Yes.
Pretty much on dimensional analysis.
Right.
T is the only scale, and that's why you will
sure.
get that.
Yes.
So, and all the other things will scale in such a way that it will, of course, provided
yeah.
the tau impurity is equal to.
Right.
The you don't have the scattering.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So
that's, I guess that's not that.
Yeah.
At least from the CFT perspective, that's expected. So.
Yeah.
So one final question. One class of materials that also show a large Nernst effect that you mentioned with the heavy fermion materials.
All right.
These works by bell and so and so forth. I mean, have you looked at any of those?
Because
those also, you know, heavy fermion physics can in some ways sort of people think is made, a lot of it's driven by quantum coupled phenomena as well.
Yeah.
So there you definitely have a sort of ingredients that you're looking for maybe.
Right. I mean, it's probably perfectly well and good model or system to look at with this form and also this organics that I was mentioning. Probably even better than looking at this.
Okay, let's have a look.